This spring, the State Office for People with Developmental Disabilities released new regulations governing payments for fiscal intermediary services provided to home and community-based services participants who self-direct the care they receive. To address the proposed regulations and explain the use of fiscal intermediaries in the developmental disabilities community, as well as the unique rulemaking from the state, we're joined on the Capitol Press Room by Michael Seereiter, President and CEO of the New York Alliance for Inclusion and Innovation. Thanks for making the time, Michael.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for having me on.
So we hear a lot about fiscal intermediaries at the Capitol, but that's largely in the context of meeting the needs of chronically ill or physically disabled New Yorkers served by the state's consumer-directed personal assistance program. How is that system similar or different from the role fiscal intermediaries, or FIs, play in the developmental disabilities community?
Well, PWDD is our state office for people with developmental disabilities, and self-direction is a personalized service delivery modality that they developed, well, many years ago, but it really allows people to receiving services and their families to maximize the control over the services that they have to design them as they please. And the basic building blocks of self-direction in OPWDD are, number one, an individual service recipient; two, a circle of support, which consists of family and friends and direct support professionals and others who know that person well; third, a broker who is responsible for actually writing the self-direction plan; and then fourth, a fiscal intermediary that not only handles all the paperwork associated with billing for services that are rendered and documentation of service delivery, which is no small task, but is also actually acts as the co-employer of the direct support professionals along with the individual service recipient. It's been around since about the early 2000s or so, where it was first proven as a pilot project with just 200 people in it. And since that time, the popularity of self-directing one services through OPWD has grown significantly. As of 2022, you had 25,000 people or so of the 127,000 people supported by OPWD in total who were self-directing their services. And the growth is, I think, twofold, if you will, or the two reasons why. You've got a newer generation of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families who are looking for more than what I think traditional services have been able to offer them, often binary choices of group home residence A or B, day program A or B. And these newer generations of service recipients and their families are willing and able to take on the greater responsibilities and the risk associated with self-managing their supports, designing, implementing, and maintaining that self-direction plan, including overseeing all the staff, any of the staff who deliver those supports. And they want to enjoy that greater flexibility and the choice of self-direction. In 2022, you had OPWDD data telling us that 95% of individuals self-directing their services are under the age of 39. 72% of overall OPWDD service recipients are under that age. And then the second reason for the growth in self-direction, I think, is due to how OPWDD has been managing the system writ large, if you will, particularly residential supports in recent years, where they manage a list of certified residential opportunities and prioritize individuals with the most urgent needs. But many of those who have such exceptional medical, many of those individuals have such exceptional medical and behavioral health needs that the providers operating those residents don't have the resources or the clinical expertise to support those individuals. And it's created an extreme bottlenecking dynamic that has brought the certified residential system to a halt. So people have been gravitating, if you will, towards self-direction. I think it's important to understand self-directed services are on average much less expensive than many of the other service delivery modalities in the OPWDD system. And the 2022 data that OPWDD has on their website, you had an average cost per person of $9,700 per person, as opposed to certified residential supports, which were $138,000 per person, and day rehabilitation programs, which were about $32,000 per person. And I think you got a couple of reasons on those things. In self-direction, people get to choose what they want to spend their individualized budget on, rather than it being more of a package deal. It's all inclusive and sometimes comes with things that you don't really want. Second, the demographics of the self-direction population being younger, the level of intensity of some of those needs is less than for many of the older individuals served by our system. And like all of us, we will need more supports as we age. And then thirdly, self-direction traditionally hasn't come with the incredible weight of the what I would call a hyper-regulatory, compliance-based, you know, micromanaging philosophy to oversight that OPWDD has imposed on the traditional service system. unlike in traditional services, in self-direction, you have no quality assurance officers coming from OPWD to check to see whether you have crumbs in your toaster or whether you've checked the temperature of your refrigerator that day, which are real examples of what happens. And that's part of why I think you've got significant pushback being levied against the administrative memorandum that I think prompted our chat today.
Yeah, you bring up two issues, cost and oversight, which seem to be at the crux of new regulations from the Hochul administration through the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities, which issued a draft administrative memorandum addressing payment standards and documentation requirements for getting paid for services. How would you describe the proposed changes, which the state bills as minor?
I think it's overbearing, and I don't think it's well-informed. The fiscal intermediary, ADM, it's an administrative memorandum issued by OPWDD in March, is largely a product of OPWDD's internal thinking with very little input from those on the ground who either provide the services or receive the services. Our philosophy to all of this system improvement efforts that really is much of the work that the New York Alliance undertakes on a regular basis is that we would be much better if we were to have conversations up front, and we would create less work on the back end if we were to have constructive conversations up front with stakeholders to arrive at a common vision and an approach. And then we would, you know, then the regulators would go through a process of issuing, you know, ADMs or regulations and things like that. We have several concerns with the ADM that's been put out by OPWDD. First and foremost, I think this is a pretty significant shift of responsibility for interpreting what is permissible and thereby the risks associated with that from OPWDD to the fiscal intermediaries who have this role in the system. The classic example, if you will, as of late has been this issue of community classes. What constitutes a community class? What's allowable as a community class? And while we all need to be on the same page about what is or is not allowable, OPWDD is looking to mandate how this is going to go, specifically through creating a community of practice. They are saying UFIs, fiscal intermediaries, must be part of a community of practice. By definition, as we have understood and we operate communities of practice on a regular basis, mandatory communities of practice are that's not what this is. It is a voluntary participation. And by the nature of that, it creates this opportunity for organic grassroots dynamics where we can cultivate good ideas, identify best practices, and bring them to the fore, proliferate them, right? And now we're going to mandate that everybody has to be part of that. Secondly, the fiscal intermediary ADM excludes organizations like ours who operate a community of practice right now. I think that was unintentional on OPWDD's part, but it would have really been would have been great to have conversation about this before it was published for consideration. And then third, I think it fails to address the financial reality that participating in a mandatory community of practice is going to cost money. Associations like ours charge dues for their members to participate and gain benefits. We have many FIs who do that and participate. But in addition, OPWD is assuming that fiscal intermediaries in this community of practice are simply going to absorb these additional mandates within the structure that's been put forth, like building and maintaining a platform. Are we going to have a learning management system? Who's hosting the meetings, who's recording and archiving the sessions, who's tracking attendance and all of this stuff? I think that there's some lack of recognition what's going on here. And then the third major piece I would say about the FI is that why are we doing this now? Right now, OPWDD has an evaluation of the entire self-direction program taking place. They are spending money on that evaluation, and having an outside entity come in and try and measure and see what's going on in the system while we're making changes to the system is kind of like trying to take the measurement of a moving object. It's really difficult. OPWDD has had a review of self-direction program almost 6 years ago now, and I don't think they implemented any of the recommendations from that study, including recommendations that would have helped address many of the pressures that are on the system right now. So all in all, we really think that there's an opportunity for real conversation, constructive partnership-based conversation, to find the solutions to how to manage the system going forward.
So with the companion consumer-directed personal assistance program, the argument has been made from the Hochul administration that there is fraud and abuse, which prompted them to, in this recently adopted budget, overhaul the use of fiscal intermediaries. And I'm curious whether you see this latest effort by the state as a cost-saving measure in the developmental disabilities community? And if that is really the focus, are there other ways that you think the state could realize savings from the self-direction in the developmental disability space?
Consumer-directed personal assistance, or CDPA, as we like to call it here in Albany, is designed and intended for individuals with physical disabilities, not people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are served by OPWDD and are eligible for the self-direction program. That said, there are some people with IDD, intellectual and developmental disabilities, who also receive a small amount of consumer-directed personal assistance services because of the arcane statutory rules and requirements that New York State has on what staff in an OPWDD self-direction program can or can't do. They cannot pass medications. The governor has proposed changing this year over year. The legislature has rejected that year over year, primarily, I think, due to scope of practice concerns. But consumer-directed personal assistance focuses on supporting people with physical disabilities, most of whom don't have that IDD, with activities of daily living or skilled nursing services that those individuals have trouble doing themselves or cannot do for themselves. Supports in self-direction have an element of what we call habilitation. It's actually written into the law. It's recognized at the federal level through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is a distinction with any home care or personal care services. This element speaks to the supports that are aimed at helping individuals gain or maintain skills that allow them to live as independently as possible. So when we're looking at the consumer-directed personal assistance program and the self-direction program, I see three major differences here. One, OPWDD approves the fiscal intermediaries who participate in the self-direction program. I don't believe Department of Health has done that. There's a significant factor right there. Number two, OPWDD has fiscal intermediaries. They all must be nonprofit organizations. The Department of Health, I believe, allows for-profit entities to exist and be in the consumer-directed personal assistance space. And then three, and probably the most significant factor here, is that OPWDD controls and approves each budget that's developed by the individual and their circle of support and written by that broker I mentioned before. DOH has not, and largely, I think, because CDPA, most of it is a managed care structure rather than a fee-for-service structure. And in that managed care structure, you have a per-member, per-month rate resources that are coming to that managed care organization, regardless of the need of the individuals. OPWDD services are individualized based on a person-centered life plan, an assessment of need, and an approval of the service delivery plan by OPWDD. So you have very different factors, if you will, that are taking place between OPWDD and consumer-directed personal assistance. And while we see this FI, this fiscal intermediary administrative memorandum, as a significant change, I don't see it as much as a significant change in terms of trying to address costs, but more in terms of how OPWDD wants to fit self-direction into a more traditional way in which OPWDD tends to oversee and regulate the service delivery system.
Well, finally, in terms of the actual regulatory approach or the means of regulating this industry, OPWDD, or the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities, is using an administrative memorandum. How does that compare to what we might think of as the traditional regulatory process in New York?
Yeah, it's a deviation from that. It does not have the same kind of approval structures in place, but at the same time, OPWDD maintains and contends that administrative memorandums hold the full force and effect of law, much like regulations do. I might beg to differ a little bit with that interpretation, but in some ways, regardless of how they're going about it, they're still going about it, whether that's an ADM or a regulation. And I think that the real issue here is more culture. I think it speaks to this overly prescriptive, compliance-based approach to overseeing this service delivery system, rather than focusing on positive outcomes for service recipients. That hyper risk-averse culture is based on, I think, a pervasive, I'm going to call it infantilization of adults with IDD. Our system has failed to honor the dignity of risk for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in many situations, and it hampers them in their ability to live the lives that they want. Sure, we need regulations and administrative memorandums and other things to act as guardrails so that providers know what's in and out of bounds, what's permissible and what's not. But taking a program, a service delivery modality like self-direction, which was originally designed as a service to maximize flexibility and to honor choice, and now to start turning the screws on it so that it will eventually fit nicely into a nice tidy little box of service delivery options that OPWDD oversees, but which don't really support people to live the lives that they want, is not the way to go from our perspective. We have been spending a lot of time over the past several years trying to drive toward change in how OPWDD oversees and regulates the system from a culture of compliance to a focus on the outcomes that are desired by service recipients and their families. And not the least of the reasons for that is that we don't have enough direct support professionals in our service delivery system to deliver services the way those services were originally designed. And we're going to need to become much more efficient as to how we deliver services and supports as we go forward, because we see no major changes in terms of improvements in that unsustainable vacancy and turnover rate amongst direct support professionals in our space in the foreseeable future. We're going to have to do things very differently in the future.
Is there anything unique about OPWDD or the community that it oversees that warrants this so-called deviation from the regulatory process? Or do you think they could get by following the same regulatory procedures as other state agencies?
I think there's something extremely unique about OPWDD and its relationship with the people that receive those services. It has a long tradition, now nearly 50 years long, of much more of a partnership-based approach to supporting people with disabilities to live the lives that they want. And that partnership really extends through, frankly, the member organizations of this association and others through that nonprofit service delivery modality. 93% of services are now delivered by nonprofit organizations and those fiscal intermediaries being part of that, rather than by the state itself. And that's, I think, what we've lost. I think we have lost much of that partnership-based approach to how does this work? These are not contracts that are like a snow removal contract. Hey, if it's 2 inches or more on the driveway, you gotta, or the parking lot, you gotta plow it. These are highly individualized services. Like this is the particular explicit need that I have based on me as an individual with a particular challenge. And this is what I want and how I want those services delivered. That's really a culture of person-centeredness that I think is very strong in our OPWDD sector that, quite frankly, I think other service delivery systems, Department of Health and others, could use a healthy dose of, frankly. Being more person-centered is really the way to go, I think, rather than trying to fit everyone into the same neat box that I don't think meets everyone's needs in any significant way.
Well, we've been speaking with Michael Seawriter. He is the president and CEO of the New York Alliance for Inclusion and Innovation. Michael, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, David.
Support for the Capitol Press Room provided by the American Heart Association. Schools are for students, families at plays, and athletic events. In an emergency, the American Heart Association believes a cardiac emergency response plan would save lives. Information about proposed laws S-4100 and A-7013 is available at act.youre.org.